All right, everybody, you know how much I love TrueCar because it's changing car buying forever. TrueCar helps car buyers get rid of the fear that they might overpay. Just in the first 6 months of this year, over 275,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network, and TrueCar users save, get this, an average of $3,221 off manufacturer's suggested retail price. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com to find out what others paid for the car you want. Then, register to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step, very simple. Just print out your savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. To see how much you can save on the car you want, simply download the TrueCar mobile app or visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
One day, nothing would move without us allowing it to happen.
Hey, folks, welcome to the podcast. This week, happy to have on the show somebody that I've been wanting to talk to for quite a while. I've known him for a long time and just a really, really funny guy and a very smart political satirist, Will Durst. Will has been doing comedy and political satire for years and is one of the biggest voices in that world. You can see him all over the country on tour. His tour dates are on his website, willdurst.com. Really cool conversation with Will about how he got started in Milwaukee and then San Francisco. And he works, he's friends with everybody. He started with Ellen DeGeneres and Dana Carvey and Robin Williams, just really a major, major player in comedy. And we talk about politics and the state of politics and have some laughs. It's really cool. So check it out. And I'm going to be doing stand-up December 3rd through the 7th. I will be at the Columbus Funny Bone in Columbus, Ohio. And December 11th to the 14th, I will be at the Denver Improv. And December 18th through 20th, I am going to be at the DC Improv in Washington, DC. So come check me out in one of those cities. And you guys have been coming out to the shows. It's been great. All these pictures and stuff of what we've been doing are on my Facebook page, Paul Mercurio. And a lot of good feedback on my interview last week with Jay Paterno, son of Joe Paterno, the Penn State football coach who was, you know, embroiled in that Sandusky sexual abuse case. And really cool conversation with Jay. He's got a cool book out. Check that out if you haven't listened to it. And keep tuning into the podcast and telling your friends about it. Thanks, people.
We got the street, suckers! Can you dig it?
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's podcast. Very excited to have on a friend and a comedian and a satirist that I've always, always looked up to and admired and thought was one of the funniest, smartest guys out there in comedy for years. A very, very funny man and a nice human being, Will Durst. Welcome to the show, my friend.
Wow. That's a great intro.
You deserve it.
A little confused about the title, though. Is that the title, the podcast?
it's just, I call it my podcast, the podcast. I know it's a little pretentious for me to say the podcast. That's a lot to live up to. Like, it'd have to be the, you know what I mean? I don't think I could live up to that.
Well, it'd have to be in the top 10. Yeah. I mean, it'd have to be arguably the podcast, you know?
Exactly. You know, hundreds of appearances on television, including the David Letterman show, Comedy Central, HBO. You were nominated 7 times as stand-up comedian of the year on the American Comedy Awards. You've got writings up the ash. You do this newsletter that I get every week that's hilarious. Your writings are on HuffPo, your podcast, and you have a one-man show, Boomer Raging, from LSD to OMG. that you're touring with right now, and people can check out where that's going to be on willdurst.com. So what is it that you're not doing? This is my first question.
I'm not sleeping, unfortunately. I need to sleep more.
I know, we hung out in Austin, which was fun. I was in Austin, Texas with The Daily Show, and you were there having a film screen that was done about you and two other really great comedians out of the San Francisco Bay Area, Larry Bubbles Brown and Johnny Steele. And we hung out with our buddies from KSRO, Steve Jackson, and it was good to see you. How did the screening go, and how's that film doing?
Screening went well. Film is still looking for distributing somebody to pick it up and say, oh, I like this, you know. So I don't know what's going to happen to it.
Tell people about the film.
It's kind of about three loser comics who never moved to L.A. or New York and tried to earn a living by doing it in their own backyard, which is San Francisco. And all three of us have been able to earn a living, you know, through the ups and downs, the comedy booms and busts. And it's kind of like, I don't know if you ever saw 20 Feet from Stardom about the backup singers for rock and roll stars. Well, this is a similar sort of thing, only with comedy. And they got a bunch of famous comics who were around at the same time before they moved to L.A. and New York. And, you know, Robin talked to everybody. So once Robin fell in, then all the other comics said, oh, yeah, yeah, I'll do it. So we got Paula Poundstone and Dana Carvey and Rob Schneider and a couple of other ones. And so it's kind of a survey of 80s comedy focused in San Francisco and the boom and the bust. And you remember, I mean, in 1994, there were 440 comedy clubs in America. And then in 2004, there were maybe 100 again. So, you know, it goes up and down.
Yeah. Well, there's a great picture of you in the green room of the San Francisco Punchline, which is a famous club. And, you know, one of the clubs, this is where you can use the word the clubs in America. And it's a great picture of you. You're all standing on it's like a stairwell somewhere. And it's like you, Dana Carvey, Paula Poundstone, Bill Maher, Robin. It's Ellen DeGeneres. It's fucking insane. Like, and I put you in that category. You'd say, well, these famous comics came out to talk about me, but I put you in that category with these guys because you cut out a path for yourself as a commentator and political satirist early on in the spirit of Mort Saul, I think, which I always admired. And what led you there? I mean, when you were starting out at the Punchline in San Francisco and other smaller rooms, I would imagine you were just getting on stage trying to get your feet wet and figure out what you were doing, right? Like everybody else.
Yeah. You know, it's stage time. It's all about stage time. I mean, I was writing and I wrote for in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I wrote for this small underground newspaper. It's called the Bugle American. And, you know, it was like the Bay Guardian or our Village Voice. And so I was doing interviews and reviews. So I got to review a couple of comedians. Yeah, I got to talk to Cheech and Chong and George Carlin and Kelly Monteith and who else? Steinberg? I can't remember. But I would ask all these comics, almost Steve Martin. I was supposed to interview Steve Martin, but he wouldn't let me interview him. So I ended up talking to him between a door. He was on the other side of a door. I went over the door. I did one of those detective things where I asked the maid where he was staying, and the maid told me he was at the Lake Geneva Playboy Club. So I knocked on his door, and he looked out through the peephole, and he wouldn't open the door. So I did the whole interview with him while he was at the other side of the door.
But he stayed at the door and he talked to you?
He stayed at the door and we did the interview for like 20 minutes, yeah.
That's hilarious.
And I would ask all these guys because I was an aspiring comic. You know, I was doing it in Milwaukee, which was kind of useless because you could get on stage maybe six times a month. And I would ask all these comics, big time guys, how you got to be a stand-up comic because, you know, I didn't know there was, you know, it was brand new. And I didn't know if there was a closet door you opened up in Utah and you were bathed in a bright white light. You were a comic. And it was so disappointing because they kept saying the same thing that my dad said. It was my fucking dad's advice. It was, you know, just keep doing it. That was, you know,
you were looking for a magic.
No, I wanted the blue or the red pill, you know, and it was my dad's advice, for Christ's sake.
Now, did this come from, you know, I was talking to Bobcat Goldthwait on the show, and he talked about his father had an influence on his comedy because, you know, he was like early on, you know, even before he started doing The Voice, when he was up in Syracuse and friends with Tom Kenny, he was like deconstructing comedy and doing these sort of avant-garde sort of weird performances. And he said his dad would like do that with the neighborhood kids. Like his dad would pretend like he was like a, like he had this one bit his dad would do, like he'd stand on the refrigerator and pretend that he was like an Evel Knievel like guy. And then he was going to dive into a jar of mayonnaise. And literally like all the kids, the little kids from the neighborhood would be in the kitchen and there'd be the jar of mayonnaise. And he'd like start like, you know, like moving his arms around, like, you know, stretching, getting limber. And then he'd go, I can't do it. It's not Hellman's. It's got to be Hellman's. And then he'd get off the refrigerator. And he said he'd do stuff like that. And it's a long winded question, but did this sort of bug for comedy come from watching it on TV, which it did for me? Or did you have somebody in your family, like your dad, your mom, brother, sister, whatever, uncle, that were sort of, I don't know, somebody that inspired you to do that?
Yeah, it's a preponderance of influences. You know, I mean, there's a tipping point that will send, you know, we boom here and boom there and boom there. And then eventually you just slide down that chute, you know, because you keep looking for it. You look for it so many times. But I have a brother who's developmentally disabled. Back in the day, we called him a retarded, you know. But Marky was part of the family, but he wasn't verbal. He couldn't speak, but he could still understand you. And he's a very happy kid, and he understood humor. And to make Marky laugh, that was the currency of the realm. In the first household. So we would all do that around the dinner table, you know, to keep him involved in the family, you know, by making him laugh. And so my dad did it, and my mom did it, and I did it. And then I also was always the new kid, because I went to like 12 different schools before I graduated from high school, because, you know, baby boomer, and my parents were divorced, so they kept moving. And even when I was in one school district, you know, they kept bouncing to a bigger school because they were building new schools. So I was always the new kid. Mm-hmm. So my way of coping with that was not to make the other kids laugh, because I wouldn't see them next year. You know, I didn't care about the other kids, but I was trying to make the teachers laugh. That was my point.
You know? Did you get thrown out of class? I used to get thrown out of class for joking around too much.
I always knew where the point was.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Yeah, I was always sly that way. I think I had gotten kicked out, you know, principal's office a couple of times, and I figured it out. Yeah.
And did you find that there was some moment there in sort of making those people laugh where you thought, oh, this would be a cool thing to do? Or just you were just – I did not personally. I just was having fun. And I could remember like seeing like Rodney Dangerfield on The Tonight Show or whatever, and then going in and doing his jokes with my friends. And they were like, hey, that you're funny. And I'm like, yeah, it's this comedian. And I remember something clicking for me, but never the thought that I'd be a comedian. Were you sort of on a path then, you think, or it was just something that was just your personality as a way to cope and deal?
Both, because I too would always stay up. I'm a little older than my brother and sister, my other brother and sister, half brother and sister. So I used to babysit. So I got to stay up and watch the Carson show. And because Central Time Zone, it was on at 10:30 instead of 11:30. So it was, my parents were much more amenable to let me stay up and watch the comic. And he would have a comic on, you remember, two or three times a week, man.
Yeah.
And I remember all great comics and comics you never heard of, you know, like Johnny Dark, who was a good friend of Letterman.
Yeah, I remember. Johnny Dark used to do bits later on at the Ed Sullivan Theater. Yeah, fairly funny guy. I remember him. Yeah.
Very funny. And there was this guy, and I can't remember his name, but he was a little rich kid, and that was his gig. And he was dark, too, and just all these comics. You know, even Jan Murray and Alan King when he was on all those guys. So I watched everybody. And I always wanted to write. So I started writing in high school, you know, for the school newspaper. And I kept that up. And then I wrote my first routine because there was an audition. They used to have at the airport lounge in Milwaukee, they used to have this review out of New York. And it was like New Faces of 57. Well, we didn't get it in Milwaukee until New Faces of 74. You know, I mean, 17 years later, we thought it was hip in Milwaukee. So they had this lounge thing, and it was singers, and then there'd be a comic who was kind of the MC and, you know, the sorbet between the band changing charts and stuff. And so the comic, he quit. They were having auditions. And so I wrote an act, and I was writing for the newspaper, and I took funny parts from my columns, and I took some jokes from Woody Allen's double album. And
really? So it's like the actual jokes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I just filled up like 7 minutes. And I went and I auditioned, and I was too afraid to do the actual audition in front of the people. So I recorded it on a tape recorder, and I went to the agency in Milwaukee that was having the audition. And it was the height of Midwestern sophistication. They were sitting around in comfy chairs, drinking scotch out of coffee cups. And this is like 5 PM. And I played my little tape, and it was so embarrassing because it just didn't fit.
You walked in and you stood there while they listened to it in front of you?
Yeah. Yeah.
That defeats the purpose of putting it on tape.
I know. I wanted to drop it off and leave, and they wouldn't let me. They called me in. No, we want to hear it. And I realized, oh, my God, and standing around.
That's a great scene.
Oh, that'd but be then a great I had scene that. I had 7 minutes, you know?
Oh, wait, they booked you from that?
No, but I had written 7 minutes, and they had an open mic, a Monday night open mic. And I've been doing theater, you know, since high school, musical theater and, you know, regular plays and stuff. And in college, I actually acted in a play where me and Willem Dafoe were the only two characters in the entire play. It was at University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. So I had been on stage a couple of times. And so I went to this open mic, and there was like 11 guys at the open mic. And the first time I was on stage with my little material, I was already like the fourth best guy the first time I was on stage, you know, in Milwaukee, because, man, some of these guys were so clueless, you know? I mean, there was an 18-year-old kid that went on stage and just did a Bill Cosby routine verbatim. And it was the one where Cosby's in Vegas, and he goes to bed, and there's a mirror on the ceiling, and he and his wife, and he wakes up in the morning, and he thinks he's being attacked by a nude skydiver, and this 18-year-old kid is doing this bit, and there were so many things wrong with it. One, you never believed he had ever been to Vegas. Two, he wasn't married. Three, everybody knew it was a Bill Cosby routine. It was just... It was Milwaukee.
Oh my God. But that's kind of where you have to start. You got to kind of, you know, it's like, you don't want to start in New York or LA because first impressions are the most lasting. And I think, or San Francisco for that matter, because I think you kind of want to cut your teeth in places where you're anonymous for a while. And it's sort of out in the.
I totally agree. I feel bad for the people who grew up in New York and started out day one at the Cellar, and everybody saw them, and boom, they categorized them, you know, that day. And to break those, you know, first impressions is incredible. It happened here a couple of times. We had a couple of comics
in San Francisco.
In San Francisco, Kevin Meaney and Ellen DeGeneres. Ellen came from New Orleans, and she came to San Francisco, and she was kind of pudgy, and she had some material, and it was kind of good, and she wasn't making any waves, and she left, and she went back to New Orleans for about a year, maybe a year and a half, and she lost a lot of weight, and she got her hair done, and she had got confidence in her material, and she came back here, and it was like night and day. I mean, the difference, because we didn't see the progression from, you know, being kind of one of the crowd to being standout, you know?
I mean,
just happened. And the same thing with Kevin Meaney. Kevin Meaney did this, you know, he was a little higher. He was held in a little higher esteem, but then he went back to Boston where he was originally from, and he cured there for like 2 years, and he came back and he knocked the socks off of everybody in San Francisco.
Did his act change dramatically from that in that time?
No, it was the same stuff, only he had a handle on it. You know, I mean,
explain to people what you mean by that, but explain to this. We have a lot of fans that are into comedy, but explain what that means in terms of the performance and having a handle on it.
There's a song in a movie called Dream Girls, and it's the end of the first act. And it's this song, Never Gonna Come Back or something. I can't remember. But the producers of Dreamgirls felt so strongly about this song and in the first act that they would never allow it to be excerpted when they were, you know, trying to promote the movie. They wanted, or the play. They wanted it to be a surprise to the audience because it is so strong. And we've heard it from Jennifer Hudson. And you get chills up your spine when you see Jennifer Hudson belt that song out. And the other day I saw it done well. I saw it done really well. And I didn't get the chills. And it was the same words the woman had. She just didn't have the same kind of chops that Jennifer Hudson had. And it's that difference. It's the same song, only done by someone who's done it 1,000 times, knows every, and she's got the pipes to do it. So seeing the difference between, you know, someone doing a pale imitation and then the real thing, that's what.
Yeah. Yeah. And did you find, what was it? I mean, obviously your writing is important to you. It still is. It's what you do a lot. It's what you do, kind of where you started. Was it not giving you something that performing was giving you? Like, what was pulling you into that direction of performance?
That I thought these were funny jokes. And I wanted to see if the audience... I've always kind of been a writer who performs rather than, you know... But my wife calls it funny bones. My wife is much funnier than I am. She pissed me off, not less than somewhat. You guys may know her. She was in a movie called Nightmare Before Christmas, and she does three of the voices in that.
Oh,
and
cool.
She's just freaking funny. I mean, Robin Williams called her the funniest woman in show business because she worked with him. She did improv with him before Mark. She knew him when he was the funniest guy in the room, not the funniest guy on the planet.
Oh, wow.
So she has been working with him that long.
And in the San Francisco Bay Area. She's from San Francisco as well.
Yeah. And she's just got funny bones. I'm a plotter. I have to work at it. You know, I tried improv a couple of times and, you know, I'm okay, but I'm one of those guys who kind of recedes in the background and becomes a conduit, you know, moving it from here to there, you know. I'm not the guy. Yeah.
No, you're understating it. I mean, you've got...
No, when I do stand-up, you know, it's me. And I was in so many sketch groups, and they're like bands. I don't know if you were in a band, but there's always multiple motivations. You know, one guy just wants to rehearse and rehearse. And one guy's in love with the chick singer, and one guy just doesn't want to rehearse. He just wants to get on stage and do it, for Christ's sake. And that asshole was me. I was that. You know? I just do it, you know.
Did performing in a group help your stand up, and vice versa? And how so?
It gave me resolve, because when you're in a group, I mean, you're so, you know, susceptible to the winds of fate. You know, things are blowing you here and there, and people don't show up or somebody cancels, you know. So, I mean, it's when you're a stand up, it's you, man. And it's all up to you, showing up and performing and getting the gig, and it's all up to you.
What got you to San Francisco, and was it the decision, okay, that's a good place to go and really hone my skills and get my chops as a legitimate stand-up?
Again, it was a bunch of things, yeah. It was that my grandma had a sister here, and so she always made annual visits to San Francisco, and she made it sound like she just loved it. And you know, movies and all the movies about San Francisco. And then when I had to leave Milwaukee, and it was fortuitous that I left Milwaukee, because I had unemployment. I had worked for this place for 18 months, a CETA program. And so they kick you out after 18 months. So mm-hmm. I was going to get unemployment, and so I had a little cushion. And I think the unemployment was $50 a week for like 6 months or something.
You were rolling in dough, man.
yeah. But I had a cushion. So I decided to get the hell out of Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And my options were Chicago, Boston, and San Francisco, because those were the three cities where you could actually make some money. Maybe not earn a living, but augment, you know, so that you could make a living eventually. Not New York or in L.A., because everybody was willing to do it for free for exposure. And I knew I needed the secondary step to get better from Milwaukee. Because in Milwaukee, man, first week I came to San Francisco, I was on stage 8 times in 1 week. It was like,
wow.
Comedy Valhalla, you know. and you know how good you get just by doing it, you know?
yeah
people don't understand the stage time thing.
Yeah, well, what happens is, I think that when your focus is off of your self-consciousness, you can really sort of dig into the material and dig into a point of view and settle into a performance, because your focus is more singular. I think when you're first doing it, you're just like, even subconsciously, like, oh, there's lights and there's a guy over there, and it's the most unnatural thing I think one can do, because you're not hiding behind the character, and suddenly you walk up in front of a bright light, bathe in a bright light in front of a bunch of strangers, and trying to get their approval is a very, it's a lofty goal, but also on somewhat, you know, kind of maybe slightly dysfunctional too. I don't know, but it's like, I understand that. And so did you find in San Francisco, was it judgmental? Was it supportive? What was the scene like there? We're talking the 70s now, right? Mid 70s? What are we talking?
Actually, 80. We're talking 80. I moved here in November 79. So I started out in 80. And then I left town in September for about 5 months of 80, and I went to Cincinnati to do a play. Then I came back, and my real push started in 81.
And how did you find the scene in terms of, you know, being an up and comer in that environment?
You know what? People had descended upon San Francisco from around the country because of Robin, and Robin, you know, was started out here. And he had a couple of interviews, and I remember in Playboy magazine, right when Robin got Mork, there was an interview with him, and there was a sidebar about the Holy City Zoo, and the Holy City Zoo just sounded like this great, wonderful club, and you know, it was like a clubhouse just mostly for comedians, and sometimes audience members would show up. You know, it's smaller than the Comedy Cellar in New York. It was kind of like, you know, that.
Yeah.
San Francisco. And so when I got here, comics had showed up from all around the country, and there was no money. You know, I mean, there was very little money.
Yeah, just so people understand, we talk about the money. Basically what happens, if you work in the major cities like New York, L.A., Boston, San Francisco, you get 20, 25 bucks to do a 10 or 15 minute spot during the week. And, you know, at least in New York, 75, 80 bucks on the weekends. you're not going to live off of that, really. You're going to make your money going what they call the road, which is every other city except the ones I just mentioned. And there you go out for, you know, 3, 4, 5 days at a time to a club like an improv in Fort Lauderdale or whatever. And you, that's where you make your money. And then you go back to your town and you kind of, I don't know about you, but I sort of, you use the city's spots, if you will, in this town that you live, almost like a gym to go to work out new material and try new stuff and experiment. And then that's generally, I think, for most comics, the MO. But a city like San Francisco, more so than New York or LA, much like Boston and Chicago, you can get, as a young comic, a lot more spots to develop faster.
And then this whole horizontal growth started happening, because what happened was cable discovered stand-up comedy because how cheap it was to produce. Mm. You know, you didn't have to pay writers and there was no music fees. And so comics were self-contained. And you had this little minor circuit, you know, I'd say like maybe 40 clubs in the country, in New York, Chicago, and LA mostly. And that was kind of like their little proving. So Evening at the Improv and Caroline's and blah, blah, and Hootie Doo. And all these, and the last two cities in America to get a stand-up comedy club were the last two cities in America to get cable. And they were Cincinnati and Milwaukee. And
those I didn't know that, really.
Yeah, they were the last two cities because there was so much political wrangling over who was going to, you know, get the money to bring the people in and just politics and stuff. But then they got stand-up comedy clubs, too.
So maybe you've got a great idea for a business and want to start selling your products or services online. Maybe you're an established business owner looking for new customers, or maybe you're interested in starting a personal website. No matter who you are, GoDaddy wants to help you succeed online. Right now, GoDaddy is offering a .com domain for just, get this, $1.49. You know, you can't get $1.49 for $1.49. That's a bargain, people. It's go time. Start your website today. Visit GoDaddy.com and enter promo code Paul149. That's Paul149, all one word, to get your $1.49.com. Some limitations apply. See website for detail. Did you find you struggled at all with the starting to, because I think at some point what a comedian does is you just want to get comfortable, then you just want to get the laughs, and then you start thinking, okay, well, who am I? What's my persona? How do I define myself and differentiate myself from the rest of the artists doing this? Did you have those conversations with yourself? I mean, you ultimately carved out a really cool niche for yourself as not just a funny comedian, but a really smart commentator, not just on politics, but you know, a social satirist. Did you find that you started to make a conscious move in that direction of, this is my sweet spot and I'm good at this? Or did you kind of fall into that naturally? How did that come about?
In 74, when I started out, it was still political. It was the end of Vietnam. It was Watergate. There was so much stuff going on. Pretty much everything was political when I started out. And my dad read like 3 newspapers a day, and my stepdad read 3 newspapers a day. So I grew up thinking everybody read 3 newspapers a day. So I just grew up, you know, talking about the news and
by the way, I just want to interrupt because that's a really good point. You know, it's funny because, and we'll talk about this in a minute because I want to get your take on it, but I think we've become more polarized politically in this country because of the cable news networks that are really just arms for the different parties, in my opinion. And very few people do that these days. My dad read a couple of newspapers a day also. And sometimes I work on The Daily Show. People say, oh, I get all my news from The Daily Show. And I'm like, well, that's fucking stupid. You should be reading, I don't care what your political persuasion is, you should be reading people on the other side of the aisle and taking in all points of view and then formulating your own opinion. I don't think people do that really much anymore. Mostly, I think your dad and your uncle, your stepdad, that's a rare thing these days, don't you think?
Yeah, but it was also a different time because they grew up before television, you know, yeah. So that's how they got their news. I mean, yeah. everything changes. You know, Walter Winchell was the guy in the 20s and 30s. And then, Walter Cronkite was the guy. And then Matt Drudge was, it all changes, So, but in 74, it was still, the 60s, especially Milwaukee. You know, that's right around when we got the 60s was 74. And so I was doing politics on stage in Milwaukee. I also did a lot of material about Milwaukee, but I came to San Francisco and this was right in the height of Reagan. And it was so, Reagan was so divisive, especially in San Francisco. And there were a lot of jokes and Reagan was great. Jimmy Carter was hard because Jimmy Carter making fun of Carter was kind of like kicking a puppy,
Exactly.
He was defenseless. And and Reagan had he had a sense of humor. He told jokes about himself when he was shot. He supposedly looked up from the gurney and said to the doctors, "I hope you're all Republicans," So I mean, just the fact that, they were doctors. I think that was a pretty easy assumption. So he was great for comedy. And then boom, Reagan, Bush. And so that 12 years, it was just, it was a seam that I was able to run with, And I remember when Bill Clinton came in, it was like churning the Titanic, trying to change my act.
Now you have to go after the left, and you fall. You're liberal. I mean, it's fair to say, right? So, like, now that was something I wanted to discuss with you. It's sort of like, how do you go about, going after an Obama, going after a Clinton when you're of that persuasion?
Clinton was. It took 3 years for me to get a decent act, and I had to augment it with social stuff. But it took 3 years for me to get.
Did a lot of your Clinton stuff hinge on the Monica Lewinsky thing, or did you try
No, I he came in 92. Monica didn't happen till 98. So by 95, I pretty much had a really good, and then I ran with it for 3 or 4 years. And then everybody became a political comic in 98 after Monica Lewinsky. Everybody just took their dick jokes and made him presidential.
Right, right. What was your angle in that you figured out for Clinton for you as someone that shares views of the left? Like, how did you get at that? What was the?
I had a joke about Clinton, and it was that I've actually repurposed for Obama. Mm-hmm. I'm a green comic. I will recycle jokes. But, the joke was for Clinton, no matter what you think of Clinton's policies, you got to admire his ability not to get involved in them. And I used that joke because a comic came up to me and said, Nato Green, I don't know if you know Nato Green. He said, "You used to do a joke about Clinton," and I totally forgot. So that was one of the ways. And Clinton was also a corpulent womanizer, and he was bigger than life, and there was a lot of stuff. And then Gingrich, and the whole Gingrich started this whole shit in 94, when the whole contract on America, because he didn't care about America. It was all about the party after 90, ever since 94. So it's been 20 years of this crap leading up to the sleepy lizard in search of the warm rock, Mitch McConnell. So that's, the next 2 years are going to be interesting. Obama was really tough because you had the racial stuff going on.
You had to be careful not to come off as racist because you were criticizing him?
Not just racist, speaking of race, I do a lot of labor gigs. And anytime I would say anything.
Are you in a church, by the way? It sounds like are you doing this from a Catholic church? I hear chimes.
Well, I'm taking confession later on.
Father Will. Just don't shower with the boys. So Obama, when you say racial, see, but he didn't make race an issue in his campaign because he didn't want to sort of win on that basis. Well, so when you say racial, what do you elaborate on that a little bit?
He's a black guy. I don't know if you noticed.
Not really. No, I.
Yeah. Yeah. So if I were doing labor gigs, I used to have a joke. I love tell jokes about Obama. Christ, I can't even see him. The halo is still too bright. And I would get at labor gigs, I would get these black women who were sitting in the front row, and they'd have their arms folded and they would just glare at me. And that's not an impunitive joke. You know, I mean, that's kind of.
No, but it's like, it's sort of like, it's, I think audience, you know, you've experienced this too. They hear buzzwords and then they shut down based on the buzzword, and all the rest of it is noise around that word. Right. Like, and it can be anything from, you know, that to, you know, whatever the word might be, but like
a rape,
right. If you say rape, you know, and it's like, you know, but you were able to get a handle on Obama. Where have you been going with him in terms of, you know, the early part of his presidency and now obviously after the midterm elections, and what do you make of all of that?
Well, you know, like during Bush, because Bush was hard, because September 11th happened in 2001, which meant that he was inaugurated on January 20th, 2001. So that's less than 9 whole months he had been president. And a lot of shit was going south. Enron, and there was stuff that was just starting to accumulate. In those 9 months, and then 9/11 happened, and you couldn't say a bad word about him. Of course, I live in San Francisco, where you could say a bad word about him.
Right.
But you know, in New York, man, you couldn't say anything. It was, you were giving the terrorists a foot rub if you said anything, and that happened all the way until the second term. And after Katrina, even the right started going, okay, you know, maybe he is,
Good job. Good job, Brownie.
It was Katrina that it was the turning point. And then about 6 months later, all the conservatives, pick it up, Bush. Yeah, we've heard it. No, you haven't, you son of a bitch. And you're gonna hear it. and the same thing happened with Obama. I think it was about a year ago where people just threw up their hands and said, come on, man, leave. You know, I mean, even the left, and I know that, you know, the whole rights strategy has been not to give him anything, not to give him any negotiating thing, but he's got to start pounding stuff, you know, like he's come up with pass a bill. And if he just keeps pounding pass a bill, you know, as a response to the immigration thing, I think that will sink in, and he could actually rescue some of his legacy. But
do you think it was a good move that he took executive action on this immigration thing?
Yes, I do.
Why? Because they were gridlock and it needed.
Yeah, basically, they were going to do anything, and this is going to expose them. And if they play it right, if the Democrats play it right, you know, if he just keeps reinforcing pass a bill every time they say Emperor Obama, pass a bill, and he will reveal all their, you know.
What do you think's been his, I mean, because it was all about hope and change, and everybody I think was feeling very good about the guy. But it's, you know, I was puzzled by the midterm elections on some of them. I think that the Republicans, I think the Democrats tend to be right on substance, and the Republicans always tend to be better on process. Meaning, there was not a bad narrative; they just couldn't get it out there. You know what I mean?
They better costumes, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like you could, you know, you had a pretty decent narrative. Gas prices are below $3 a gallon. While there's still unemployment and the economy's not perfect, there is a Dow that's 17,000, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, we're sort of
Obamacare works.
Yeah. So what fell up, like, someone who does this for a living, where did it fall apart in your eyes? What did they do wrong, and how did they lose the Senate?
You're always going to lose the Senate. It was you know how many seats the Democrats had to defend, right? I mean, it was like 2-1 how many seats they had to defend, because this was the 2008 crew that came in on the coattails of Obama, right? So there were a lot more Democratic seats that they had to defend compared to Republican seats. So it was going to be hard. That was part of getting out the vote was also a bitch. Democrats had this great thing in churches and black churches and, you know, minorities, and they did great in 2008, 2012. They didn't do well in 2010, 2014. There's something about people's energy and passion. That was another thing. Now, you look at 2016. Now, the Republicans are going to have to defend 24 seats, while the Democrats only have to defend 10 seats. So it's a 14-seat advantage and if the Democrats can, you know, slide in with Hillary, they could win the Senate back easily in 2016.
Yeah.
If shit turns their way, you know. So, and they don't have anybody who can sell it. I mean, it's hard. It's easy to say, oh, Obamacare stinks and Obamacare, you know, but when Obamacare works, who's going to propel it? You know, I mean, right. who's going to champion it? You know, well, and it's easy to say Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi. And then what happened the day before yesterday? The Republican Investigation Commission came back and said, oh, there was no problem with Benghazi. Oh, don't worry about it. You
know? Right. And Lindsey Graham went on and said, it's a bunch of crap. And, you know, meanwhile, the head of the Intelligence Committee that wrote the report is a Republican. So it's like, you're never going to get. Does it get any better? I don't know, you know, and in terms of the partisan politics and the inability to work together, right? I mean, I think that from your perspective, for you as an Obama fan at one time at least, what is it about him that's disappointed you, or where do you feel like he's fallen off the rails?
In terms of rallying the people behind him, he hasn't gotten the people, and he has a salable narrative. And if he had just kept saying they won't work with me, pass a bill, I think that he could have gotten certain constituents behind him. And I think he should have done this immigration thing before the election. And I know that was a political thing that all the other Democrats who thought they had shots in the Senate race, you know, were begging him not to do it. But he's going to lead at some point.
Yeah. I mean, it's like apparently the politics, he's not great at the politics inside the Beltway.
He was always a facilitator. He brought people together. You can't bring these people together.
Yeah, but you got to be good at the politics, right? I mean, Johnson, there's those great tapes of Johnson just working the phones like a motherfucker. You know what I mean? Like, what? Don't you think that that's one area where he's been lacking, that he just doesn't have that either desire, ability, or both to kind of really massage these guys on the inside?
Well, Johnson kind of owned the Senate. By the time he was, Senate Majority Leader, he knew where every single body was buried. Mm. He had he didn't need opposition research. He was his own opposition research. So that analogy won't work, but you also have to remember that ever since Roosevelt, that Republicans have refused to work with Democrats. Now, they had to work with Roosevelt because in the first couple of terms, he had such an overwhelming majority. But you look at ever since then, Kennedy, they hated Kennedy, man. Mm. The John Birch, they killed him, for Christ's sake. And then Carter, they hated Carter. They just couldn't get him. Johnson came in with the honeymoon of a dead Kennedy. You know, he was untouchable, and also he was untouchable because he was Johnson. He knew where everybody was buried. And even that, they talked him out of giving it up. And then Nixon for two terms, and then the guy that Nixon appointed to the president, and then Jimmy Carter, they refused to work with him. He only lasted one term. Same thing with Clinton. They refused to work with him, and they just pounded him. And, You know, it's a pattern. The Republicans refuse to work with Democratic presidents. And Democrats, you know, they don't have the same kind of lockstep. You know, people don't Democrats are not Democrats. They're not just one guy. You know, it's not the Borg. The Democrats, you got Mary Landrieu, who's a conservative Democrat. And then you got Barbara Boxer, who's a liberal Democrat. You don't have that kind of thing in the Republican Party.
Do you think that are you surprised? I'm a little bit surprised that the Republicans don't have a clear... They've had a lot of time to figure out their candidate for 2016, and they don't have there's not a clear front runner.
At this point in 1990, 2 years before the 92 election, nobody knew who Bill Clinton was. I'll tell you who I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of Jody Ernst.
Why?
And she'll have 2 years in the Senate. And she has, I mean, talk about a backstory, talk about, selling her as a feisty conservative. I really think that, she is, if not for the top of the ticket, you know, the undercard.
Well, I see her and I just see Michelle Bachmann with short hair. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but smart. Michelle Bachmann, many things you can say about Michelle Bachmann. Smart was not one of them. Jody Ernst is smart.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Do you think he plays to the rest of the country? Do you think that he...
I don't think he's conservative enough to win the primary.
See, I think the party never really sort of gets off the ground if they keep letting that far right wing of the party control their nominee. Because ultimately, I mean, I think anybody that gets into office, they tend to hover, maybe with the exception of a couple of presidents, hover around being centrist for the most part, slightly to the right, slightly to the left. I mean, that was Romney's problem, you know. Like, but I feel like they're gonna keep making the same mistake over and over again. I was having a conversation with Ann Coulter, and she was saying, you know, the Republicans, instead of you know, trying to sort of kowtow to immigration and this and that, just own it. Say, you know, we don't really, we're a bunch of white people who don't care about that. And I say to that, you've got to step into the 21st century. You can't keep thinking that way. You can't keep marginalizing a group of people that continues to grow and grow. So
you're going to lose Texas in 8 years.
Right. And if you told Republicans that they were going to lose Texas, they'd say you're crazy, but you know, they don't seem to get it. And so you look, well, now there's talk that Romney's going to do it again, and maybe he's going to run. Who do you see? I think Hillary's probably the lock for the Democrats, right? I mean, it sounds like she's going to run.
My problem with Hillary is there's nobody in the on deck circle. You know, I mean, what if she trips and falls? You know, and people start talking about her health. What if she actually has a health scare instead of Karl Rove claiming she has brain damage? Mm. You know, what if, you know, who's warming up in the pen? That's what I'm and Elizabeth Warren's not going to run if Hillary runs, you know, which is only fair and right and true and just. And
how about John Kerry as her running mate?
I don't know if Kerry might be damaged goods.
Oh, from the election.
Yeah. Interesting. The Republican side, you know what? David Brooks said this in February of 2012, before Romney was picked on. And he said, what's going to happen in 2012 is the Republicans are going to decide on a moderate and they're going to lose. And then the right wing will become incensed and they will demand somebody from the Tea Party run in 2016 and they will get crushed. Mm. And I think that prognosis still holds true. I think either Huckabee or I don't know who it's going to be, but they're going to get somebody bad.
who What have you been saying about the Tea Party? I'm sure that you, I mean, I've read some of your stuff, but like, what's been your take on the Tea Party from a comedy standpoint? Just I'd love people to hear a couple of your thoughts on that.
The Tea Party, you know, because it's racial, if not racist. Face it, there are some people who are never going to be comfortable with the fact that America's being governed by a black guy living in public housing.
I love it. That's great.
And then a half black guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't that
exactly.
Just like America? Yeah, yeah, we can elect an African-American president, but first, I don't know, why don't we try out a half black guy?
Yeah, you
know, like a starter Negro, baby step, a hybrid. We work our way up to Samuel L. Jackson.
It's like a training wheel. We put training wheels on him. Did you, this whole Ferguson thing, this is going to air probably about a week after Ferguson happened, and no indictment. Were you surprised by that? And like, does this ever change where, you know, young black guys are getting shot and nobody's getting nailed for it? Or what are your thoughts?
You know, I have so much hope for the kids today, because the kids, you know, don't care about black or white or gay or straight.
Right.
You know, the kids, because they grew up watching TV and they see, you know, that Will Smith, you know, is just a normal guy, that Ellen DeGeneres doesn't have cloven hooves, that, you know, Anderson Cooper is not, you know, a monster. And so the kids don't care about all this. But in the South, and don't kid anybody, St. Louis is the South, man.
Mm.
It's Missouri. And this whole thing, you know, it just keeps propagating, but it's less and less every generation. You know, all those old people who don't understand blacks, and it's less and less every generation. It might take 10, 15 generations, you know, until we're all the same color, until we all look like we're celebrating carnival in Rio de Janeiro.
I hope it changes over time, but I don't even know if it's 10 or 15 generations. I remember, even to this day, you go down south to work and some people use the term Yankee in 2014. They're using the term Yankee in 2014.
I know.
And you're like, you know, I'm just looking around. I'm Italian. I think I'm okay. I don't think I'm considered, but I'm still looking around for the noose. You know, it's like, dude, this is 2014.
Mercurio, that's an Italian name. You Catholic?
You like a Sicilian Italian in Africa? You probably got some black in you, boy. You know,
true romance, man.
So, out of curiosity, I always am curious. Sometimes, you know, you've worked as a comedian so much. Like, have you ever found yourself, and I'm sure you have, where you're just, you get a heckler, you're stumped on stage, or you're just going down a road with material and it ain't clicking, and you're like, okay, what am I going to do with this? And how did you get out of it? Any sort of funny anecdotes about that?
Oh, I just move on. No, I just move on. You know, I mean, you know, when you do in-deck editing, when you have like a four joke bit and the first two don't work and you just skip the next two, you know,
right.
I just move on. I bail.
And you pussy. You're a pussy. Come on.
I am. I'm a total pussy. My job is to make the audience laugh out loud on purpose against their will. That's tough enough already. I'm not going to try to. I mean, we can plant seeds. We're not going to change the way somebody thinks, but we can plant seeds of doubt. I mean, that's, as Barry Crimmin says, he's the Johnny Appleseed of doubt. You know, I mean, that's what we can do. But we can't change the world from stage at a comedy club, for Christ's sake, where the guy before you just did a giant pussy joke. You know, I mean,
what do you do when you have to follow the giant pussy joke and you want to go up and talk about Tea Party? Do you just go for it, or you have to start off with like your own pussy joke?
No, you just, you try. you got to be your own sorbet, man. You get to change it. Yeah, I always try to do something so they get used to the voice first, you know. Mm-hmm. So try to have some jokes up front that are generic, you know. Mm-hmm. And using cities or locations in San Francisco. And now, you know what I found that I can use now is my pro gay material. I can use that because it's kind of sexual, a little bit salacious, and you're still making a political point.
Oh, because, that's interesting.
Yeah. And everybody is pretty much, you know, any comedy audience, you know, anti-gay marriage, you know, who gives a shit about gay marriage? How does two people's happiness make me miserable? And I can do that up front. So get them on my side, because pretty much everybody is, you know, obviously I don't work the South. I got a deal. If you draw an invisible line between Atlanta and St. Louis, I don't work south of there, and they don't hire me. So we got
it's a deal you struck. What's your take on medical marijuana and legalization of marijuana and all that? Like, I assume you're for it. Like, are you like shocked at how long it's taking? Are you surprised how quickly it's happening? Where do you stand? What are you talking about your act on that?
I haven't broached it yet, but I'm going to, because I have to write a new show. I'm going to call it Durst Case Scenario, because I did this little one-man show about being a baby boomer, and a lot of theaters liked it, and I did okay, but they won't let me come back with the same show. They want me to write another show. Jesus Christ, it took 2 years to write this show, and now they want another show. So I'm going to have to deal with medical marijuana and Colorado and now Oregon and I think Washington too. Oregon, Washington, Colorado.
Do you ever think about running for politics, getting involved, doing taking that leap out, like a la Al Franken or, you know, some of the others?
I don't have skeletons in my closet. I have the whole bone army from the Seventh Voice. There's no way.
Is there a drug you haven't done? Let's put it that
exactly.
way.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's funny. And do you think that, ISIS, the way we're going after, what do we do with terror? Yeah, what are you talking? Are you talking about that in your act and the terrorists?
How come the president won't call it ISIS? How come he insists on calling it ISIL? He's the only one.
I think because he wants to annoy them. That's his way of, you know, it's like how some people from the South will say, are you Italian? Like they'll do that to you. I think that's his way. I don't know.
And Bush would always mispronounce Hussein's name. Yeah.
And nuclear. It was like he was taunting the weapon, you know.
That was my joke when Obama first came in. You know, it's so refreshing to have a president who he speaks with a foreign leader. The other guy isn't more eloquent than English as a second language.
But Bush had this ability to be that everyman, I think, right? Don't you think there was some of that, like coming off of Clinton? These are always reactions to the guy that was in office beforehand, right? Like,
yeah, he looks like a guy you can have a beer with. Yes, but we had to take away the car keys.
Nice. How do we defeat ISIL or ISIS? Any suggestions there? Any thoughts?
No, man, that's a never-ending war. You know, the only way that can be done is through education. And they, you know, they're throwing acid in the faces of girls who go to school. That's, you know, we never had that. You know, you and I.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, people throwing acid in the face when you went to school. You know, I didn't need that big of an obstacle to, you know, make it importune.
Yeah, I mean, I had to deal with maybe an atomic wedgie. That was my big issue. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think that the terrorist thing never goes away. And I think that's why I'm always shocked that people think we're going to go and have one more war and it's going to be done. It's just like whack-a-mole, man. It's like we got to get our heads around it, that we're going to be in a fight forever, you know?
And it's going to be like, you ever see the movie Brazil where they're sitting in the restaurant mm-hmm. and someone blows a bomb and they just go on eating, you know, and yeah. that's going to be us.
That's going to be like, it's like, oh man, it's going to, you're going to look up and be like, oh man, I got dust in my tapioca pudding from the bomb.
Yeah, shit. I hate shit. When this happens.
All right, listen, people have to come see your one-man show. They go to wilderse.com to see where you're touring with it. You got any performances coming up in the San Francisco area in the next few weeks or month?
Yeah, well, we're doing our big fat year-end kiss-off comedy show, and we're expanding it this year. We're doing 9 days instead of 7, and it starts the day after Christmas, and it goes to January 3rd, and it's me and Johnny Steele and Devin Mike.
And oh, wow.
Mari Magaloni and Arthur Gauss. And we do skits and sketches and stand up all about stuff that happened during the year.
All right, cool. Well, people can check that out. They can see where that, the times and everything, go to wildurse.com, I assume, for that.
Right. Or the, right. yeah, you can check out Big Fat Year End Kiss Off Comedy Show on Facebook. Just go to Big Fat, you know.
All right, Big Fat. And I'm going to be at the San Francisco Punchline March 4th to the 7th. So hopefully you're going to be town then. We can hang out and maybe come by and do a guest set at the show. And we'll hang and shoot the shit some more. But this has been awesome, man. We got to do another one of these because there's a lot more we can talk about. So we'll get you on again. And
No. Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
You're the best. Everybody needs to go see Will Durst. Read his all his stuff online, HuffPo, website, willdurst.com. Subscribe to his newsletter. I get it. It's really smart and really funny. You're the best, man. Love you. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you, buddy. Take great care. We'll see you around the pool. Have a great bird.
All right. You too. See you, buddy.
Bye.
All right, so that's Will Durst. We're going to do more with Will. He's so funny, and he's sort of that just wise dude that has a really cool insight into what's going on in the world, and you should check him out on tour and check out his writings on HuffPo and all over the place, and he's got a podcast as well. And please check me out doing stand-up December 3rd through the 7th at the Columbus Funny Bone. December 11th to the 14th at the Denver Improv, and then December 18th through 20th at the DC Improv in Washington, D.C., my little stomping ground where I went to law school. And this thing's growing. Keep it building. Tell your friends about the podcast. Give it as a stocking stuffer, as I've been saying. We want to keep building the subscribers. It's a free download every Monday. You guys are the best. Thanks for listening, and have a great, great day.
You take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf.
Because it's all our turf.